Good morning. It is 7:19, and we have in studio this morning early. Rich Sontag is here. He's dropped by to talk to us about the Park City lunchtime Rotary program and the small grant applications process that is now underway. Welcome. Thanks for coming by.
Good morning, Carol.
Yeah, so Rich, tell us a little bit about the Rotary program. I guess this is a yearly thing, and you're trying to get the word out about the small grants.
Right. Well, again, we have a lot of local nonprofits that are on the small side, and this message is aimed at those that have an annual operating budget under $500,000 a year. But every year, the Park City Rotary puts on a program of grants to the smaller nonprofits. These are grants that are $500 to $1,000 each, and this is funded out of the Miner's Day proceeds from the running of the balls. And the Park City Rotary has this basically an application period. And between now and July 30th, the small nonprofits are invited to go online to parkcityrotary.com and fill out an application to receive one of these small grants. And these are for programs and scholarships that have to occur here in Summit County. And again, I think I said the application deadline is July 30th. And there is also the opportunity for, we're going to give out two larger grants of $5,000 to $10,000 for a couple of the smaller nonprofits who can come up with a program that just has specific local benefit that the grants committee believes is important and relevant. So this is a chance for 20 to 30 smaller nonprofits to get online, make an application, fill out the purpose that they're going to use the money for, and the grant committee will consider that during the month of August. It'll be funded from the Miner's Day proceeds, and the applicants will be notified of their awards in September.
And how much money are we talking about?
Well, that's allocated every year out of the proceeds of Miner's Day, but typically it's 20 grand or so in that neighborhood, and might be a little more this year because of the impact grants that are also going along with the program. But again, this is a long-time tradition for the Park City Rotary. Most of the local nonprofits who enjoy this process are involved in getting out there, but there may be some new ones. I wanted to get the word out to them as well to get online. It's parkcityrotary.com. The application process is online, and there is also a banquet being held for local small nonprofits on July 9th. And if you go to that same website, you can sign up to come to the luncheon and find out more about the program.
Okay, and is there a deadline for application?
The deadline for application is the end of July, July 30th.
Well, you are listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. News time is 8:10, and I'm going to introduce our first guest this morning. Emily Summers is the Senior Communications Manager from Deer Valley, and Jenny Dearson is the Economic Program Development Manager. Here joining her, they're talking about some of the events coming up at Deer Valley this coming week, and maybe some of the traffic and parking implications that go with a couple of, well, at least one sold-out performance. Welcome. Thank you for coming in. So, Emily, give us an idea of what you've got in the works for this weekend.
We have our sold-out show, which is part of the first in our Deer Valley concert series with Michael Fronte and Ziggy Marley.
Okay. Would you mind just repeating that, because we had a little bit of problem with our mic?
No problem.
Sorry.
It is a big weekend coming up. We have three shows, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Tonight starts our Deer Valley Music Festival with the Utah Symphony, and that's Chris Boddy. And tomorrow night, special guest with the Utah Symphony is Marie Osmond. And then on Sunday is the sold-out show we've been talking about. So many people probably know what's going on, but it's the first of the Deer Valley concert series this summer, and it's Ziggy Marley and Michael Fronte.
So with that giant amphitheater, how do you sell out a show?
Yeah, we know about what our venue can take and what our capacity is just on that hillside for people to have a good experience. And that number sits under 5,000. And so we sell it out just to make sure that, you know, parking, transportation, the hillside, the concessions, everything can handle that amount of people.
Okay, so with a sold-out show like that, Jenny, what do we do as far as the city and managing those kinds of crowds and kind of keeping those all of those cars out of town?
So we've been in a great partnership with Deer Valley. We've actually been working on it for quite some time now, but we're excited with this concert coming up this week. In particular, we will be running additional buses from the school district, so from McPullen and Treasure. So they will go directly to Deer Valley starting at 4 o'clock in the afternoon until 11 o'clock. And that is just one of the great things that we do to really help with regards to transportation. But the partnership really is across the board. So Deer Valley hires staff to help direct people in the parking lots and help with pedestrian management. And then we also have our police officers in the road to help direct traffic, but really to also to give transit priority. So those that do ride the bus, and there are a lot of people riding the bus, really can get up to the venue quickly and then also leave the venue quickly. So I just think it's so important to talk about that partnership. And there are so many parts that go in place. And so it's everyone that is carpooling. It's not fun to go to a concert in a single occupant car anyways. And it's also really fun to ride the bus. And there's a big effort, I think, between both of us.
So where are the satellite lots?
The best place to park for this concert or for the Deer Valley Concert Series is at McPullen and Treasure, of course, with the construction at the school district. So we've been directing people there all summer long, and that'll continue to be a great place to park for the series.
And are those lots big enough to handle the
Yeah, and what's great, too, is that when there are satellite lots, we're seeing people carpool even to those lots themselves as well.
Okay. And what about the other side of town, the other entry corridor in the Kimball area? Will there be any busing coming from Ecker?
Yep,
from the
so
Ecker
busing
lots?
Continues every day from Ecker Hill, and then you can catch transfers as well up to the Deer Valley area. So it transfers, I think, at the Old Town Transit Center here. So we continue to have transit as a priority throughout town.
Okay, great. And let's talk about you're pretty sure it's dry over there now.
Well, we had our first show in the venue this Wednesday, thanks to Mountain Town Music and that community series, and that went really well. Forecast, you know, the temperatures have been really helpful. So it's looking good. We've done some improvements as well. We're moving our concession stand and the entrance to the venue, so people who are used to our venue will just see a little bit of a different entry into the venue this weekend. But yeah, it's looking good.
Okay, great. Anything else that you would like to say about the...
Just want to make sure that people know that the sold-out show has the satellite option from McPullen. The symphony shows tonight and tomorrow do not, because they're not big enough. So we're just implementing these this satellite option when the shows are large and sold out.
I would also add, there are always buses going up to Deer Valley, so you can take the bus. It is the Red Line and the Lime that go up to Deer Valley, and so you can continue to do that as well to the shows tonight. But again, just additional transportation that both Deer Valley and Park City have worked on for the sellout shows that we have coming up.
Yes.
Okay, sounds great. All right, thank you very much for coming by.
Thank you.
Arthur Middleton, he's on the line with us. He's a biologist and curator, and he will be talking to us about the new Yellowstone exhibit, Invisible Boundaries. And he is going to be giving us a preview of what people can expect today, I believe, is the opening, June 28th. Arthur, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great. So tell us a little bit about what this is a multimedia exhibit, and it involves partnering with a renowned photographer, Joe Reese, and others with film and photographs and all kinds of interactive displays. Tell us a little bit about the exhibit.
Absolutely. This really is a multidisciplinary exhibit where we wanted to bring all the tools we could to bear on really celebrating the animal migrations of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. And so that meant bringing kind of the latest cutting-edge science, showing the long-distance movements of some of the key players like the elk, the mule deer, the pronghorn of the system, and then working with the photographer Joe Reese and artist James Prosek and a filmmaker Jenny Nichols to bring in the real kind of visceral experience of what these animals go through. In the case of Joe's work, the photos and videos really show how arduous these journeys are. You know, the 10,000, 11,000 foot passes that these animals cross, the raging rivers, the artwork really tries to expand the story to remind us that there are a great number of diverse migratory wildlife across the system, not just the hoofed mammals, but the birds and insects and fish that move throughout the system across all of its boundaries. And so, yeah, it was a real effort to bring everything we could to that story and try to sort of reintroduce the greater Yellowstone, always sort of a microcosm of the Western landscape, as a really vibrant, moving system full of these long-distance animal movements that make it what it is.
Yeah, so Arthur, how did you go about capturing the imagery? And, I mean, were you out with the animals for some extended period, you and the other artists involved here?
Yes, very extended periods. I think if Joe, my colleague who did the photography and videography, were here talking with us, he could explain some of the details of he kept logs of how many miles we covered, just to check particular camera trap sites. I think there was one where he had one photograph he felt really proud of, which is actually in the exhibit. It's a huge photograph of an elk cow with a really young calf climbing a high pass on their migration. And he said that photograph took about 800 miles on horseback over 2 years, just trial and error, you know, managing the camera traps to get the perfect image. So that's just one example of some of the labor that went into generating some of the images.
So how long altogether have you all been working on this exhibit?
Well, this was a culmination, I think, for each of us, of years of independent work. I've been working with colleagues and state and federal agencies in particularly Northwest Wyoming, but also across the Greater Yellowstone, to document with the GPS collars and other tools the migrations that are featured in the exhibit. That's been going on 10 years of work for me now. And Joe had been working on the antelope and mule deer migrations in the southern part of the ecosystem before he came to this exhibit and featured the elk migrations the others as well. So it was really a bringing together of many years of individual work into this collaborative effort to showcase the migrations.
That's interesting. So 10 years, what kind of observations have you had? I mean, climate changes over those 10 years, how has that affected the patterns, the behaviors of the animals that you've been able to observe?
Well, that's a good question. We're still learning. One of the things that you can see if you visit the exhibit, at the very sort of heart of the exhibit, is an interactive map with a 3D topography of the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, onto which the aggregated data that we have on the migrations of the major elk herds, 9 major elk herds across the ecosystem, is projected. And so what you can do there, you mentioned climate, is you can look at how snowmelt and the greening of vegetation and the return of snow in the fall push these herds into core areas and back out every year, sort of like a pulse, you know, in and out in spring and fall. And that really illustrates how this phenomenon of these migrations is totally driven by these climatic forces that determine patterns of snow and plant growth. When we've looked at that through our analyses, We do see some trends. We see later and later arrival of some of the elk herds on their winter ranges over the past 20 years. That's been challenging to explain. It may be related to snow depth changes. We haven't seen changes in spring migration, but you know, it takes really long-term data sets to be able to make those determinations, and we're still accumulating that information. The advent of GPS technology, even though it's been around a while, still was relatively recently. And that's what's given us the really detailed information that we can use really to drill into this stuff now. So I'd say we still have a lot to learn, but we certainly know that climate is the primary driver of a lot of the things that influence these migrations.
Yeah, sure.
The bigger thing, of course, in the system in many areas is residential development out in some of the outlying landscapes. And so, you know, if you visit the exhibit, you'll see discussion of a lot of these different forces and concerns that are influencing these animals.
Yeah, you'd mentioned that you were on horseback. Was that a lot of the way you were able to track and catalog the animals' activities?
Yes, we worked with an outfitter here in out of Cody, Wyoming, to do a lot of that work. A lot of the work we can do now with satellite collars, you know, we capture elk and other ungulates on their winter ranges when they're more accessible and let them go with collars on, and they do it a lot of the work for us now by kind of leaving a trail of breadcrumbs, if you will,
yeah,
with their GPS collars. But there are still other kinds of observations that we can only get, you know, through blood, sweat, and tears on the ground. And so we did spend a couple years of summers out on foot and on horseback getting to where these animals go for their summer. And in the case, for example, of the Cody elk herd, which is now, I think, the second largest of the greater Yellowstone elk herds after the Jackson herd, Cody elk herd at about 6,000 individuals. Those animals spend their summer in one of the remotest places in the lower 48. So even though they're near the town of Cody in the winter and out on ranches and private lands, by the summer, they've moved 60, 70, 80 miles into the backcountry, and they're hard to get to.
Yeah. So we're going to have to wrap it up here. What are the details? Joe Reese, the photographer, one of the photographers here, is going to be presenting a lecture on Saturday and a book signing as well. And to give us a little detail on how long the exhibit lasts and what the hours of the museum are and that type of thing.
The exhibit will be up until mid-August. And you caught me without knowing the hours that the museum is open. But
we can find it.
Yeah, I'm unfortunately stuck here with two little kids, and I can't even see the exhibit myself and its installation there until a little bit later this summer. But it'll be up for most of the summer, and Joe and I will be there at different times to give talks, and I'm sure that information will be available from the museum. And I just really encourage those interested in wildlife and what we're learning about wildlife movements in the West to go check it out, because I certainly put some work into it, but the work of people like Joe and others really was a years-long, you know, effort of with a lot of passion to create some of the images you'll see there. So go see it.
Well, thank you. Arthur Middleton, biologist and curator, part of the Invisible Boundaries, Yellowstone Invisible Boundaries exhibit that is currently showing through most of the summer, it sounds like, at the Utah Museum of Natural History. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Bye now. Well, it's 8:28. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. Our next guest is Becca Gerber. She is a Park City Council member. She's here to give us a recap of the meeting last night. Let's welcome Becca. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
And let's kick off with the decision, the vote that was taken to support, it was unanimous, to support donating $550,000 towards the conservation of the Armstrong Snow Ranch Pastures area. That Utah Open Lands has been working so feverishly on for many months now.
Yes, you know, we were in a really great position to continue working with them. When we passed the bond, in November for Treasure and Armstrong, we heard overwhelmingly from our community that they were in support of us preserving both pieces of land. And we are in a really strong bonding position as well. Nate Rockwood, who manages our capital budget, he was able to, because we got such a good rate on our bonds, and as well as a bond premium, we were able to only bond for, I think it was $47 million of the total $48 million bond capacity that we had. So we did have another $1 million in bond capacity as well. And in addition, we got such good rates that we were already, our citizens were already going to be paying less than they were told that to expect to be able, that they would be paying. So we were in a really great position to still have that extra $550,000 in bond capacity available to us. And then we heard overwhelmingly from the community last night. It was really wonderful to see how many people came out and support the letters that we received, the texts, the emails. We've really heard from so much of our community that this was important. And then also as a bonus, at the last minute this week, Carrie Armstrong announced that she was also going to be putting a conservation easement on the Red Barn if we could conserve the rest of it. And so the Red Barn will be placed under a conservation easement at Utah Open Lands, and all of that land total back there will be preserved. So it's a really exciting time for our town, and that was really the last big piece of open space that in city limits that we had our eyes on.
Okay, so but there's still $385,000 that needs to be raised between now and Sunday?
There is. And so, you know, I'm hoping Wendy has a few more tricks up her sleeves and there are a few more people out there with some money to give. But we really saw people coming up to the mic last night and donating money last minute. I know our community can do this. So let's keep fighting. $300,000 left to go. Reach out to Utah Open Lands and Wendy Fisher, and let's make this happen.
So as far as that open space parcel, it mm-hmm. will now be all one parcel under mm-hmm. a similar conservation easement, both, or will there be one under an agricultural conservation and one under a different category?
I couldn't tell you the details on the conservation easement. I know that I believe that Carrie Armstrong will continue to live on the property where she lives now, but the whole land will remain as it is and will be placed under a conservation easement in perpetuity.
Okay. Were there any people there who spoke out against it? Just having, you know, perspective that we had just passed a bond for Treasure.
You know, it was really interesting. We didn't hear anything, even through email or in the streets. We didn't hear any negative comments on it. So it really does show you how important public support for something is. When we really hear from the public that they are in favor of it, it makes it much easier making some of these harder decisions.
Yeah, sure. Okay, let's move on and talk about Hideout. Diane Foster, city manager, mm-hmm. explained to us this week that the town of Hideout is trying to change its annexation policy. Mm-hmm. It looks like basically they're looking to expand to include some land that is owned by Park City.
Yes, so it is an area expansion plan. So it doesn't mean that they're headed out to annex all of this land tomorrow. But it was a little bit unusual in the way that they went through the process. It wasn't the standard process that the state requires cities to go through. And they did include parts of Clark Ranch and Richardson Flats in the Quinns area that Park City and Summit County have been planning the development of, or the undevelopment of, as most of it is under a conservation easement for a long time. And so there was some concern about that. And we decided last night that it would be a good time to update our annexation expansion area and include that in part of our plan, just so that we can forecast out to other communities, the county, Wasatch County, areas that we may be interested in annexing in the future. But it is just a plan. It isn't an action that we are looking to take anytime soon.
And that was initiated by the Hideout City Council?
Yes.
Okay.
The Hideout City Council put out an annexation expansion area plan. I believe it was almost 2 weeks ago now that did. It was quite large and included Richardson Flats and Clark Ranch and quite a bit of area over by the Mayflower as well.
Okay. So the next steps, how long will it take for the city to sort of revisit and update the annexation plan?
So it has to go through the Planning Commission, and there's a requirement of 14 days notice before the open meeting at Planning Commission, and then there's another 14 days notice before it goes to a public hearing, and then there's another time requirement before it comes back to City Council, and there's some work that needs to be done. And so I believe that the Planning Director, Bruce Erickson, said it would be about 4 to 6 months before it could officially be a part of our area annexation expansion area plan. AEA, as they said, there were a lot of acronyms flying around last night. It can get a little bit overwhelming.
Yeah, okay. I hate those acronyms. All right, so we'll just follow this with Bruce and see where things go over the next 4 to 6 months and go from
exactly
there. Okay, so the council also decided to uphold a determination by the Historic Preservation Board. Mm-hmm. So can you explain what that is and what properties we're referring to?
Yes, it's just one property down on Park Avenue, and I'm sure many people recognize it. It's just kind of below where the billboard is, and it is a unique property because it's not from the mining era. It's the it's a building from the transition from mining era to the ski recreation era, and it actually is a building that was built during a time when Park City was primarily, I guess I shouldn't say primarily, but it had transitioned into a bit of a ghost town, and there wasn't a lot of construction and a lot of homes being built during that time. And so we felt that it did tell a part of the story of Park City. It speaks to a time when we weren't as prosperous, when the mines had really died down and we were kind of shifting and finding our way in town. And the building has really remained largely unaltered since it was originally built. And so we did feel that it had held on to its historic character and was an important part of the story of Park City.
Well, and it sounds like it prompted a conversation about ski era buildings, historic value, and how that fits into Park City's overall historic picture.
Yeah. So my understanding of historic preservation is that it's really important because it helps tell the story of a community and it tells the story of a town. And we have done a really good job so far of telling our mining history. And we're starting, with this building, with some other buildings, we're talking about that transition into ski recreation, but we haven't really told the ski recreation part of the story. So whether or not that moves into a part of our historic conversation is yet to be told, but there was a little bit of discussion about that last night.
Yeah, and in the past there has been discussion about A-frames and defining those as historic structures, and where does that stand? Do you happen to know off the top of your head? Or
my understanding is that they have not been designated a historic building type in our community, but that buildings that are over the age of 50 years in our community, as long as they fit within, these other specific eras, can be considered historic. So I think we would have to make the ski, early ski recreation something, an era that we would preserve, mm-hmm. and it isn't as of right now.
Okay, let's move on and talk about the 248 mm-hmm. environmental assessment. There was a public meeting held a couple hours on Wednesday, I believe, at the Treasure Mountain Junior High School. This was the findings mm-hmm. of the UDOT study that has been going on for more than 2 years now on 248, looking at some of the problems with respect to traffic and mm-hmm. congestion and traffic flow, that type of thing. So it seems like, based on some of the observations there, people were a bit surprised by the outcome that came from UDOT. What are your impressions?
Yes. So, this is a public process. This is a federal process that we have to go through. We know that we have some flow and congestion issues on State Route 248. And this is the process that we have to go through to have changes made. And I think that if there's one thing that I can say was that UDOT heard loud and clear that our community wasn't happy with a lot of the changes that were being suggested. And we really encourage people to continue giving their public input. We don't have to go along with this. There is an opportunity for council to make it, there were some alternatives laid out, and there are some opportunity for some other alternatives still, I believe. But this is when the community can really help shape this process. This is the point of public process. And you can continue to give input on this project until July 11th. If you go to the city website to give public input on this, you have to go through the formal process that is outlined by UDOT, which means you have to send an email directly to the UDOT site, and there's a link on the city website. So make sure that you give your input through that process and give your comments through that process. Otherwise, it won't count.
It sounds complicated.
It's not that complicated. There's okay. a link. You fill out a form online and say, hey, I like this. Hey, I don't like this. And this is why. But they will continue gathering public input until July 11th. And this isn't set in stone. This is an alternative that we are still discussing. And there's still a lot of opportunity for us to give input and shape the project in a way that we might feel better fits with our community better.
So $1.6 million was spent on the study, mm-hmm. and that was paid for by taxpayers, mm-hmm. by Park City's taxpayers. What happened as far as the communication? Tell us a little bit about why our transit expectations weren't infused into their direction. Why?
You know, I can't really speak to that as I wasn't a part of the UDOT committee that was making these decisions, but my understanding is that we are a unique community and we have different goals than a lot of communities in Utah. And what works for other communities in Utah isn't something that is going to work for us. And we're letting that be known at this time that we have a different vision as to how we see transportation in and out of Park City. But the environmental assessment and all of the studies that were done, they are still good studies. They are still valid. It still gives us a good picture of, you know, the wetlands and the traffic and what's going on in that corridor. So it's not money wasted. It's just that the outcomes, I think I've heard from our community would prefer to be different.
Okay. And what is the city thinking on this? Have you made a statement as a council, or where do you take it? And when do you speak out and say, we don't support it, we do support it, we would support it under these circumstances, that type of thing?
We have to keep going through the process. And so, as I said, we will keep accepting public comment through July 11th. And then after that, it moves into an additional process. And we'll hear back at that point in time. But I'm not sure exactly what the dates are when we will have a final proposal.
Okay. And ultimately, it is UDOT that decides.
No, there is an alternative. There was an alternative in there that was do nothing. And so at the very end of it, if we're like, you know, that we are absolutely opposed to this, we can still vote do nothing.
Okay. But doing nothing isn't very feasible.
No.
Is it?
But, I mean, again, we're hopeful that the process will continue and work in a way that meets the needs of our community. But we do have, a veto at the end an option not to do anything at all.
Yeah, and just going back to the beginning of this study, initiating this study, mm-hmm. really the objective was the city and the community felt like transit lanes were needed, mm-hmm. dedicated transit lanes. Right now we don't have very, prolific bus schedules running out that way. We don't have that structure. We've got mm-hmm. this gigantic parking area, Richardson Flat, that sits empty almost all the time. Mm-hmm. And there is discussion about building another park and ride lot across the street from mm-hmm. that one. And, it just seems like it's been a lot of money just to say we want transit lanes.
You know, the hardest
part. An oversimplification?
Maybe a little bit, because it's not a city road. It's a state road. And so anytime you want to have something done on these roads, you know, we can't go out and say we would just love a turn off of I-80 right here because it would be more convenient for us and it really would work for our bus stations. There's a process that you have to go through when you work through these governmental agencies. And so we're working our way through the process, and we've actually jumped quite far ahead in this process because our city staff has been willing to put money and time into this process and help us move forward, because otherwise it would still be far out for us looking for solutions. And there's a reason that you have an open, transparent process where there's a give back between the community and the developers or in the state, in this case, the state. So we don't feel like we're being dictated as to what's going to happen on our roads right now.
Okay.
We feel like this is part of the process that we have to go through to get funding, to get some resources for our community to make these roads better.
Well, and there is another alternative that Alfred had discussed and that's not talked about very often as an option, but that is to take over the road mm-hmm. and to petition UDOT that Park City will be responsible for some section of it. Mm-hmm. Has that been part of any conversation at all?
As far as I have heard, it isn't, roads are very expensive.
Yes, and, they are.
So it would be a big discussion for our community, and it would actually, it would be a very expensive decision for our community to make at this point in time, and I don't think we're ready to go there. But there could be conversations going on that I don't know about, but I have not heard anything.
Okay, we'll leave that. We'll leave that. Sorry,
we'll leave that there.
To hammer that down. Anyway, just quickly on affordable housing, a recent discussion was held in council, mm-hmm. and there were some public criticisms drawn from that conversation regarding affordable housing. There seems to be a delineation of just which workforce people who are working in the city should be, you know, eligible or get more of a priority to win affordable housing lotteries, mm-hmm. that type of thing. And the mayor commented even that that addressing the service workers and lifties is an entirely other conversation. Can you talk about what that means? I mean, is it different? Is the workforce housing different from the service housing that we're talking about? I mean, aren't we talking all workforce? These are people who not only run our lifts and service the hotels, but they also teach in our schools and work for the police department and mm-hmm. the fire. So talk to us a little bit about where.
This is still a really hard discussion in our community where we understand that we need affordable housing in our community. Really, the cost of housing has gotten so high that really no one, if you are working in Park City, can afford to live here. I think the median house sales this year, or house listing price, is $2.2 million. So that really cuts out most people. And we still need to hear more from our community about affordable housing. But my concern when we discussed the weighted process was if you weigh it for some people, that means you're weighing it against others. And as we have a discussion about social equity, where really the number one issue brought to us by the survey that the Park City Community Foundation did, and what we've really heard in our listening tour over the past year, is that housing is the number one concern for most people. And that goes across all socioeconomic demographics. It goes across all races. It goes across all ethnicities. It goes across really the whole population of Park City. There's a lot of concern about affordable housing. And so really, it's a complicated discussion that we need to keep having with our community. We need to hear from people. But really, everyone needs housing in this town. And it's going to be, we still have a long process to go. We are getting into the rental housing. Will come up soon, and that will open some more doors for people. But my personal belief is that we want to make room for everyone in this town, regardless of what your profession is that it really takes everyone to make a community like this function, and everyone, I don't even know exactly the right words to put it at this point in time, but, you know, we're having this conversation about valuing and recognizing and appreciating our marginalized communities in this town. And there are a lot of people that don't feel welcome and don't feel safe. And so really, when we talk about our housing programs, I personally would like to be as inclusive as possible.
But
there are others on the council that feel that it's an easier discussion to have with our community right now if we highlight some of the professions, such as teachers and police officers and firemen.
So some of your fellow council mm-hmm. members expressed that there wouldn't be community support if mm-hmm. the lottery was weighted or not weighted mm-hmm. more heavily towards those positions. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of implications inside of that. And, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of social media commentary about, well, look at the demographics of those mm-hmm. people who are police officers, mm-hmm. firefighters, and teachers, and working for the city mm-hmm. and for the county, that type of thing. But they're typically Caucasian, white Caucasian people, whereas the service industry is really supported by our brown population. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that's kind of the elephant in the room here. And is it really your impression? I know you can only speak for yourself, but is it your impression that that the community would back away from support of affordable housing if it was to be more of an equitable playing field?
I can only speak for my feelings for that, but I will turn the question and say I would love to hear from the community and hear that they support housing for everyone. And if we're not hearing that, then I guess it would prove that the rest of the council is correct in their beliefs that the community does feel better about having it weighted towards some professions. But the discussion right now for me has really moved on to the fact that this is an issue nationwide, and it is not about, whether or not you can afford to live in Park City. It's whether or not you can afford to live in Utah or California or anywhere. It's just their housing has gotten expensive and wages haven't risen as fast as the cost of land and the cost of housing. And so we really all, it is my personal belief that each and every community in the nation right now is going to have to step up and talk about how we make housing affordable for our necessary workforce. And that does include teachers and firemen, but it includes the people that work at the grocery store. It includes, everyone who works in a community that makes it function.
Okay.
So it's a really complicated and it's a very hard discussion. And we are really just delving into it with a social equity discussion as well. And so, again, I guess this is an opportunity for our community to provide us with feedback and let us know what they think and speak to us on this. That part of the discussion was held very late in the evening, and we didn't have anyone else really there to provide us with feedback. And I would love to hear from the community as to what their thoughts are on this. It's hard. These are very hard discussions for our community, but they're so important. And they are really the conversations that are going to dictate who's here in the future and what kind of community we have in the next 20, 40, 50 years. So
okay,
please come out and join us. And also, if I can throw in one last plug for Utah Open Lands and in their $300,000 fundraising stretch. So they've got keep supporting open space and keep supporting housing.
Yeah, we've got about 48 hours to go. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. That's Becca Gerber, Park City Councilperson. Appreciate you coming by. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, good morning. It is 8:52, and my final guest with the local news hour is Bill Malone, the president and CEO of the Park City Chamber and Visitors Bureau, and he's here to give us an update on all things summer recreation, visitorship, and people sleeping on our pillows. Thanks for coming by.
Okay, thank you. You had asked me a little bit, kind of looking into the crystal ball as to what the remainder of summer, and I say remainder kind of loosely since we just started summer this week. There's some interesting I think aspects of our overnight visitation when it comes to summer. Our summer business has grown over the past, I'd say, 20 years. Probably on an average of somewhere between 3% and 4% per year over that time frame. When you look at summer as a part of our overall visitor economy, it has stayed, though, kind of about the same percentage from a financial standpoint. And I think, we tend to look at summer from a weekend standpoint. When we're off work, many of us, and we look and we see, okay, how many people are at Silly Market or how many people at the 4th of July parade. But it's very interesting when you kind of break it down in summer and from an overnight standpoint, our busiest nights of the week in summer are Wednesdays and Thursdays. Our slowest nights of the week are Sundays and Mondays. And I think what people tend to forget is about half of our overnight business in the summer is group business, is corporate group business, especially at the larger properties, the properties that have meeting space. And so I'm going from here off to welcome a group that's here of about 100 people for a corporate meeting. After this morning, we have some very good-sized groups. We have later on in July, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation is having a major event here. And when I look kind of on a daily basis at lodging occupancy, you can see those peaks, and those peaks are basically midweek. And then when you look at what's on the books, primarily what's on the books are those meetings that are being booked 1 year, 2 year, even 3 years out in advance. And those of us traveling on leisure, we pick up the phone on Wednesday and book a room on Friday. And so what we're tracking is that long, you know, long haul business pretty much, as opposed to the nightly business that you pick up just on, hey, I watched the weather. It's going to be a great weekend in Park City. Let's go.
Well, it sounds like good tag teaming, basically, if you're getting the midweek business. And then you're, of course, many of our events, that the bigger events, are going to be weekend events.
Correct.
It's interesting. Are you finding that the people that are coming in for the, and I don't know if you track this or not, for the business meetings, are they returning at any point in time in the future? Are you able to even determine that?
Yeah, we don't have a real good tracking mechanism on that, but from a surveys, we find that people are very pleasantly surprised. Usually their first time here, many times, you know, for a meeting, and they immediately talk about coming back with their family.
Yeah.
On a vacation. So it's a great introduction to the community. And you know, I mean, meetings in Park City in the summer aren't usually locking you into a box for the day. They many times include a fly fishing time or bike rides or, you know, outdoor activities. And that's really the motivation why the people have selected us to hold that meeting.
Yeah, yeah. Other options. Yeah,
they can go to Chicago and sit in a ballroom.
So how do projections look as far as, you know, nightly stays, that type of thing?
Yeah, pretty good. When I look out at both June and July, up in excess of 10% at this point in time, what is booked. And still have a ways to go because that, as we say, that leisure business really doesn't book until late in the game. So I think overall, if I were to look at summer right now, we have on the books about 9% better than what we had last year. And that surprises me, you know, because that just that natural ability of looking at what our weather was for the last few weeks and that, you know, going, why would you come here, you know, and then, you know, at least we weren't in Steamboat Springs where they got 21 inches of snow last week. So, we're in pretty good shape there, but, it's just, you know, that business, that group business that we go out and solicit and go to trade shows and meet those meeting planners and entertain them here. We find that that's really valuable to us because we can put that on the books, and then we're booking business for 2022.
Now. Sure. Okay. Anything else?
You know, overall, there's a couple of peaks in the summer that are kind of interesting. We're looking forward to Tour of Utah, and that's a little bit different for us. This is the first time we've had both a start and a finish on 2 days in a row on Saturday and Sunday. And we're doing a campaign on that, trying to build that as a destination for the weekend to come and watch cycling for those people who are strong cycling aficionados. We're doing some advertising on the Tour de France in certain markets, trying to talk to them about if they're a big Tour de France fan. This is a great opportunity to be up close and
so that's going to be
personal.
Starting soon, and you'll be seeing what comes of that. Well, thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
I appreciate you coming by. That's Bill Malone, CEO and president of the Park City Chamber and Visitors Bureau.